I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When the Marine Commander, Major General James N. Mattis, took control of Fallujah just a little over a week ago, he said it was the right place for his soldiers. When it comes time to move the piano, he said, the Marines don't just move the piano bench, they move the piano. Little was he to know that days later, he'd be facing what may be one of the most pivotal points in the American occupation of Iraq. Major General Mattis had started with plans to win the trust of people in cities like Fallujah. He also has $500 million in reconstruction money that was supposed to help. But then came those horrible images of the American security men burned and dismembered. So now the Marines fall back on another line, a Marine phrase that their commander is known to quote, no better friend, no worse enemy. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, speaking in Baghdad, says there will be a response.
This is a cancer inside the society of Iraq that shows no indication of leaving anytime soon. Although small, it's a malignant cancer, and we need to take care of this together with the people of Iraq, the Iraqi security forces, and the coalition forces, because unless it is dealt with, it does have the chance and does have the possibility of getting larger.
So here's the question for us today. How important is this moment in the war for Iraq? President Bush wants people there to support his plan for stability and democracy. He wants people in this country to believe in that too. Has your confidence, your sense of what's ahead changed at all with the expression of outright fury we saw this week in Fallujah? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start today with John Lee Anderson. John Lee is staff writer for the New Yorker magazine, and he's joining us from Baghdad, where he has been for a good part of the past year and for the past month. John Lee, it's good to have you with us again.
Thanks a lot, Dick. It's a pleasure to be back.
John Lee, because of the graphic and gruesome nature of these pictures, I mean, it's a moment that is being marked on here in America as a shift. I'm curious to know, for someone who has to get up in the morning and get in a car and go out and just do reporting in the Baghdad area, did it change anything for you?
No. It's been getting worse here steadily over the past year, and significantly so in the last month. That is, to be a Westerner here in Iraq, not specifically a journalist. Security has deteriorated as Westerners and Western civilians, not just army vehicles, have become targets. There's been at least, by my count, 14 or 15 Western civilians, including Americans and various European nationalities, murdered in Baghdad and around the country in targeted killings over the last 3 weeks. There was the bombing of a hotel used by again, Western civilians, some Arab and Turkish businessmen, and other attacks against small, unprotected hotels. These images that we saw out of this horrific incident in Fallujah is, in fact, it's only a slight departure in that there were cameras there and the people actually mutilated the bodies and hung them from girders, but if you'll recall, over much of the last year, when there have been these incidents of bombs that have killed one or two or destroyed an American vehicle, very often you will have, if it's near a population center, you'll have a gang of boys and men who come out and jump up and down and sing praises to Saddam or long live Islam and usually down with America. It is only the most graphic example of a widespread resentment, which has its fulcrum in Fallujah as a kind of bellwether for Sunni resistance to the occupation. But the resentment of foreign occupation of Iraq and the slipshod manner in which it has been proceeding, and the insecurity that has accompanied it, not only for us but for Iraqis, is widespread.
Now, it's been a long time, I understand, John Lee, since Americans, journalists, or others can, feel in any way comfortable in a place like Fallujah. But what part of the story would we be missing if we just looked at those television pictures and sort of had that gut reaction of, oh my God, how could one group of people do that to another group of people? What are the Iraqis there reacting against?
Well, you know, there have been incursions into Fallujah as recently as I think it was about 10 days ago, in which there were even airstrikes used against parts of neighborhoods, and I gather a number of civilians killed. There were more than one incident. There have been Iraqis killed in American incursions into Fallujah recently, and then, of course, many times over the past year. And you have to remember how this all began. The American Armed Forces moved into Fallujah late. This city fell to the Marines and the Army on April 9th. In the days following that, the Americans spread out around the country to Crete. Saddam's hometown fell some days after that. And towards the end of the month, I think it was the third week of April, the Americans moved into the western towns of Fallujah and Ramadi, west of here, which are predominantly Sunni. That is the group from which Saddam Hussein came and derived his power predominantly. Quite independent-minded, desert, small cities, tribal, clan-based, always xenophobic, never particularly hospitable to outsiders. They gave the British a fiery time back in the 1920s as well.
John Lee, I wonder if I can just interrupt you for a minute here. What one of the things that people are curious about is whether or not that level of fury that was seen in the pictures from early this week is distinctive to a very small group of people in Fallujah, or whether or not you're now getting that kind of look through a car window driving around in Baghdad. Are these just a few thugs, or is it something different?
Like I was saying before, there is a widespread resentment towards the occupation, and to some degree that has become a sectarian sentiment towards Westerners generally. It's very difficult now for me as an American to go around the city without feeling very self-conscious that I'm a compatriot of the people who are also patrolling this country in boots and helmets and guns. The occupation is, by and large, resented. If indeed many people appreciate the fact that Saddam was gone, and particularly the Kurds and the Shia feel a great weight lifted off of them, all of them would like to see the Americans gone. Some of them have pragmatic responses to that. In other words, they feel they need them for protection, let's say, from terrorists or from neighboring countries for a certain period of time. But I think it's unanimous that they would all like to see them gone. There is an increasing amount of insecurity. There is an expectation now that Westerners will be attacked. I feel very self-conscious about sitting in a restaurant. That is, that I might bring fire upon the Iraqis sitting there. I know of friends who have been in places where they've been told, they've been made to feel unwelcome for the fact of the security of the establishment. Our translators are now being targeted. They're regarded as collaborators. No distinction is being made between Iraqi translators working for the U.S. Army or for journalists. It's a situation of sectarianism and xenophobia which has been created here, which simply did not exist before the occupation.
And in that restaurant or in any restaurant, would people be coming up to you and expressing their anger, or would people also be coming up to you and saying, you know, we don't want America here, nobody here wants America here, but we don't support the degree to which the people in Fallujah reacted earlier this week?
To be honest, I haven't gotten a lot of that. I know that some people have elicited those sorts of comments, but then Iraqis are a people who operate on several levels. This was a society that had to operate on a number of levels under Saddam Hussein, and it's very difficult to take anything people say at face value. When they're confronted with any kind of authority, it is their time-honored custom initially to jump up and down and sing praises, just as they did when the Americans initially entered. But they can do that, and there's all kinds of ceremonial rituals which one goes through, particularly out in the hinterland, whereby one is invited to a meal and sit down, and after a period of time, if one pries, the resentment can come out. And because of the ethos of hospitality, nothing will harm you in that encounter, but you can very often be being treated to a veritable banquet and come to the realization that you are faced with someone who regards you as his mortal enemy. So even, you know, the sorts of articles you may be seeing or reports out of Fallujah in the last few days where people are saying, we were happy that they, that the Mujahideen attacked and these army people, these American army people, but we are ashamed of how their bodies were treated. It gives you an example of that kind of schizophrenia that is really current throughout the psyche here. I think, you know, a great deal of many metropolitan Iraqis are askance at this kind of behavior. But nonetheless, the people that did this in Fallujah are part of the population, and the same kind of thing can happen elsewhere in the country, and it's not exclusive to the Sunni. You'll recall an incident early on where some British soldiers were brutally murdered and attacked in an incident which seemed to have more to do with a cultural understanding down in the supposedly safe Shia South early after the war, an incident which wasn't repeated because the Brits, I gather, began to adopt different tactics. But the Americans are faced with a very difficult situation here, where by now, after they're now saying they have thrown down the gauntlet, they're saying that they are going to pacify this town, and I think they're setting themselves up for a very difficult public relations scenario if they can't achieve that. This has always been a recalcitrant place, and it is related by clan and tribe throughout much of central Iraq and western Iraq.
John Lee, I'm going to stop you there. Thank you for being with us, and ask you to, as ever, be careful, will you?
Thanks a lot.
John Lee Anderson is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. Let's go to on the phone to Washington, where retired Army General William Nash is joining us once again. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. General Nash commanded Armored Brigade in Operation Desert Storms, a former regional UN administrator in Kosovo. General Nash, nice to have you back on The Connection.
Good to be with you.
We've only got about a minute before we have to take a break, but I do want to just get from you, what was your reaction when you saw those first pictures from Fallujah? Did you see it as a pivotal moment in this war?
Well, I think pivotal may be a little strong, but it's certainly a very serious situation that we, A, have to come to grips with, and B, we've got to see our way through it.
Pivotal perhaps in the way that the public will react to it, though.
Certainly, that's a possibility, though I think a lot of folks have tried to compare it to the situation in Mogadishu a long time ago, but I would say this is the whole environment and the cause that we pursue here, much, much different circumstances. So I think the national resolve is greater, but that doesn't lessen the difficulty of the challenges facing us.
And we'll talk about that national resolve with General Nash when we continue after the break. We'll also get word from someone who has been taking the temperature of the American public and will give us some new insights into the way people are thinking, not just about the events of this week, but the war in general. We'd like to hear you on that. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Word from Baghdad yesterday and again today that the military is preparing a response for the killing and then the mutilation of the corpses of four American security men in Fallujah earlier this week. What should the U.S. response be, in military terms or in other terms? And how important is this moment in the war in Iraq as you view the conflict? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm going back to General William Nash, who's on the phone with us from Washington. And General Nash, you're talking about the resolve being different than in Somalia, and I think you're on with that. I mean, this is a war that people have been making their mind up about now for, in many cases, more than a year. But what does that mean the options are for the military now in terms of a reaction? Having promised something, does it have to contain a certain amount of retaliation or a response with brute force?
Well, I think you'll see a combination of actions. If I could make a couple of points at the beginning, I would say that the forces that have moved into the Fallujah area in the last several weeks is the first time a, quote, permanent force has been assigned to Fallujah with the knowledge that they're going to operate there for an extended period of time. Unfortunately, as John Lee talked about, the moving into the Fallujah area was not something that was done in the early days, and then in the early confrontations with the folks there, there were many difficulties and possibly inappropriate actions taken. So as the Marine forces, reinforced by two Army brigades, have taken responsibility for that area of Fallujah and a much larger area of western Iraq, I think you'll see, regardless of what happened the other day, a much more measured, deliberate, strategic approach to the area that will combine force with incentives for cooperation and participation in the political process, which ultimately will be more important than military actions. Having said that, and given what occurred several days ago, I think you will see a response. I think you'll see a strong response. I think you'll see involvement of Iraqi civil defense and police forces in conjunction with U.S. forces. But I also think you'll see, while you'll see a lot of sticks, I think there'll also be some carrots involved in the overall operation.
Let's bring Chris Gelpy into the conversation. He's joining us from a studio at Duke University. He's associate professor of political science at Duke and an author of a forthcoming book, Paying the Human Costs of War. Chris, good of you to join us.
Thanks for having me.
You have been asking questions of people about this war. Have you been asking questions just in the last few days? Did your research change when these events in Fallujah became well known to the American public?
Well, we're actually in the process of asking some questions about Fallujah right now, but unfortunately I don't have results specifically on Fallujah, but we have been asking for some time now questions about willingness to support the war in Iraq and willingness to tolerate casualties in Iraq and also looking at some previous wars. And I think it is the case that incidents like Fallujah can become key sort of turning points in the public's willingness to support a war, as it was in Somalia 10 years ago. But I think General Nash is right that it need not go the same way this time. The public's resolve could be higher, but I think a lot depends upon how the Bush administration responds to these sorts of events.
The interesting thing is that although we call it a war, it isn't actually a war where this country is saying, well, we need to have winners here and losers there. It's a war that the president keeps reminding us, in his view, is about establishing a certain amount of stability and democracy and peace in that country. So when you're talking to people through the polls and saying, do you support it and do you not, what's the measure that people use? It's, you know, it's not a sort of yes, we must win or no, we can't lose.
Yeah. That's a good question. The thing that the research I've done with my co-authors here at Duke, Peter Fever and Jason Reifler, the thing that we've identified as the most important factor in determining people's support is the extent to which they think the U.S. operation will be successful. And when they say successful, they tend to mean that Iraq will be stable and democratic. And we then ask them, how do you judge whether things are going well or not in Iraq? And interestingly, almost nobody said that they judged whether the U.S. was likely to be successful based on casualties per se. That only 2% of the respondents said it was U.S. casualties. Instead, what the public tended to say that they did in terms of judging whether we were likely to succeed is they were looking at whether Iraqis are cooperating with us against the insurgents. And this, I think, is why incidents like Fallujah can be so dangerous, not just because of the number of deaths, which, are, you know, obviously the deaths are tragic, but it's not the numbers that matter so much, but the way that the mob violence may create a perception that ordinary Iraqis are not on our side.
And not only just the incidents like Fallujah, but then the response, the U.S. response. How is that measured?
Right. And I think whether or not the U.S. response will be successful will depend upon whether they can in fact follow through on their claim that they will pacify the city of Fallujah and places like it, so that we will no longer see this sort of public opposition and anger towards the United States. I think expressions of that kind of popular anger are one of the things that are most likely to undermine the belief that we're going to be successful.
Let's hear from some of our callers. Let's start in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Dave's on the line. Dave, thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
What are you thinking?
Well, I'm very aggravated by this situation. If we cannot show some measure of force in Fallujah and, in fact, pacify the city, I would love to see the president give those people, that city, 15 days to get out and then level the city. I'm not advocating killing the population. I want them to move out. But then I would level that city and I would not rebuild it.
You think some kind of a marker has to be put down here by the U.S. military?
Exactly. In World War II, after Nagasaki, the Japanese got the message.
General Nash, let me start with General Nash here, just in terms of whether or not that kind of calculation goes into the military figuring out what the best response is.
Well, they're certainly going to have, as I said earlier, a considerable degree of force associated with the operation. But I think as we look at the long-term implications of what the American people value, that kind of collective punishment to the entire town of 200,000 plus will not, in fact, sow the seeds for our long-term success in Iraq or in the region. And while we have to have deliberate, measured, and overwhelming force as we go about a deliberate, measured process, as I said, in due course, carrots have got to be as much a part of this, and inclusion in the political process and the protection of the people. And we just got to remember who we are and the values that we treasure as we deal with this most difficult situation.
Dave, back to you. You're in the service, right?
I'm retired Navy.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Well, I understand that it may not plant the seeds for an immediate success. However, we put up with this guerrilla warfare stuff ever since Vietnam, and we always seem to come out where our guys are getting picked off and bloodied and beaten and humiliated publicly on world media. And there comes a point where you have to take a stand.
And Chris Jelpy, is this a point where taking that kind of stand is something that you're getting a sense, not only Dave, but other people are saying is appropriate?
Well, I can understand Dave's anger in terms of responding to what happened. I think that sort of response is understandable. But I think if our long-term goal is to get ordinary Iraqis to cooperate with the United States against the insurgents, I think General Nash is right that kind of large-scale, overwhelming collective punishment is not what is going to be viewed as legitimate by ordinary Iraqis. So I do agree that there needs to be a very strong response, unlike what we saw in Somalia. I think there does need to be a very strong response, but I think we need to be very careful that response is viewed as reasonable and legitimate and targeted by ordinary Iraqis.
But General Nash, I mean, things seem to have reached a level of toxicity in relations between certainly people in that part of Iraq and the U.S. military forces at this point that, I mean, I'm not advocating any particular course of action, but I'm wondering if that kind of harsh response isn't going to end up making things even worse.
Well, that's exactly what I just cautioned. and we can't be carried away by our emotions. And we have to think less in terms of revenge, if you will,
right,
and more in terms of fixing the problem, both in the short term, but more importantly in the long term.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia. Now Ted's on the line. Ted, thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Gordon. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, it's funny because I usually consider myself your only conservative listener, but after that last gentleman talking about leveling the place, I might have to adjust myself a little closer to the middle. But I think I'm always kind of astonished that people are so surprised by the fact that these things happen. This is a part of war, after all. This is what we should expect out of what happens when we get ourselves into it. And not only that, but I think that we can expect to see a fair amount more. If we really want to do the job there, unfortunately, there will be lives lost on both sides. And let's hope that it doesn't go as far as it could. But at the same time, really, the American public should be ready for this. The media should start to realize that we will see more of these images on television. That's part of the process.
To me, what made it stand apart, Ted, was that aside from all the soldiers who've lost their lives in the various attacks on the convoys, was the sort of unmitigated glee that you saw in the face of so many people who appeared to be cheering around the burning vehicles and taking part in the humiliation of the corpses. Now, I mean, even the Iraqis, some Iraqis have said, okay, that was a little bit over the top. But the fact is that it happened, and people were quite happy to do that, fully aware that a camera was there. And I, in my view, that's what makes it stand apart a little bit from everything else that and all the other deaths that have been reported. Do you not see that difference?
Well, certainly there were parts of Germany that were not happy to be liberated during the Second World War. They were just as happy to be under Hitler's rule. And, of course, they had to be pacified at that time as well. So I think that there are certainly holdouts that are loyal to the old regime. From what I understand, Fallujah was not only one that Saddam toadied to quite a bit, but attempted to kind of make sure that they were not doing the same things to his forces. But history is rife with these. We've got a force now that's working there, the American Marines,
yeah,
that are not only one of the most moral and ethical forces history's ever seen, but their commanders are held to an accountability that commanders have never been held to before. So we've got a force in there now that I'm 100% confident as part of the American populace is there to do the job and do it appropriately and responsibly. I think that they need to talk tough and they need to go in and be tough. That's part of teaching or showing people over there exactly how we intend to deal with these things. So I think we will see more of this. I think the Marines will take care of it. I think the Marines, that's their job and that's what they've done for hundreds of years. So I think that we can expect to see a little bit more of it, and we need to harden ourselves to the fact that this is an aspect of war that we don't always see on television when we see a clean missile.
Ted, I want to stop you there because I want to turn to Chris Gelpy and go back to what you said at the very beginning as in identifying yourself as one of the many conservative listeners of The Connection. Because, Chris, your research is showing you that the opinions and ideas about what's going on in Iraq even recently are becoming increasingly less partisan, isn't it?
Well, what we found is that it's really, despite what one hears from a lot of the polls, it's really not party identification per se that determines whether or not people will support the war and whether or not they're willing to tolerate American deaths in the war. What really is important is two attitudes. One is whether or not they believe the attack on Iraq was justified, and a second is whether they believe the United States is likely to succeed. And once we account for those two beliefs, party ID is not so much the source of the opinion. Now, it is the case, I should say, that party ID does have a substantial effect on whether or not you think the war was justified.
But we're moving a little bit past that, aren't we? Go ahead.
It has less of an effect on whether people believe we're likely to win. That really is, I think, more an assessment of events on the ground.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take another call. This one from Arlington, Massachusetts, and Ahmad is joining us. Hi, Ahmad.
Hi.
What are you thinking? Yeah, you're on. Go ahead.
Well, I actually have a question rather than a comment. In case of a paradigm shift in the Bush administration or a change in the presidency, how long would it realistically take to pull out of Iraq? Are there any available estimates at this point? And just a general idea of what will be required in terms of construction, strengthening civil and political institutions, reassuring economic stability, et cetera, before that could happen.
Tough question. I don't know, General Nash, any idea on how long before the U.S. could pull up its tents?
Boy, that's a hard one. I would say that even given a major inclusion of international forces and a major change in the whole international community's approach and cooperation with the United States and Iraq, that there will be significant U.S. involvement for the entire term of the next president, whichever that is.
And Chris Gelpie, how much of the way that people respond has to do with deadlines, either real or imposed? I'm thinking of the end of June when you know things are supposed to hand over to Iraqis, whether or not people are responding saying, well, we only have to hang on till then anyway.
Yeah, actually, we did ask about that. We asked people how long they thought it would take until we would be successful. And we found a reasonable amount of patience among the American public, although not infinite patience. About 30% of the respondents said that they expected we would succeed within 1 to 2 years, and about 30% said more than 2 years, and then about 20% each said either we would never succeed or we would succeed in less than a year. So there's a small segment of the public that is likely to start to get impatient if we're not successful right away after June 30th, but a majority is willing to wait at least a couple of years. Whether they can wait 4 years, I don't know.
All right, Connection listeners, what is your level of patience? What's your expectation? And what are the measures that you're using mentally, intellectually, psychologically, emotionally to measure what's going on in Iraq? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program this hour, Chris Gelpie. He's an associate professor of political science at Duke University and author of a forthcoming book, Paying the Human Costs of War, which analyzes public reaction to this conflict. General William Nash is with us. He's a senior fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations and a retired Army general, commanded an armored brigade in Operation Desert Storm. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston next. Matt's there. Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks
for taking my call. It seems that there's always a fatal flaw between that we think we can solve things by just sending in the Marines. I remember Johnson saying that the Vietnamese would be afraid when the Marines hit the beach in Vietnam. And that wasn't the case at all. I mean, there's no understanding of the local culture. We think, and the military thinks, that we're going to bring democracy to Iraq overnight, and we're doing a favor for them. I don't think there's any Iraqis except the governing council who believe that that has any relationship to the truth.
So what happens now? What should happen now?
Well, it's going to turn into a civil war because they've done no political work. They're trying to put their cronies into the governing council so they can get the oil. And it's become evident that the reasons for the war weren't thought out, and there was just a gut reaction to because of this need for the oil and to avenge the assassination on the president's father.
So you're saying that in the short, medium, long term that the United States Army is going to pull out and the Iraqis will tear themselves apart because of what's happening?
Well, I mean, we don't even have anybody there who, I mean, at least in the case of Vietnam or Korea, we had a political force there. I mean, we're taking something from nothing. But I think the real issue is, you know, in Vietnam, it's like when McNamara sat down with the Vietnamese later, he said, just read the history books. You know, this was a civil war. This is what we were trying to do. And we just haven't done our history work, and we have this crazy idea that America is so great that we can just send in our army, and that's going to solve problems. That's great for taking territory. That's great for beating the Taliban. But trying to actually do something that is human, forget about it.
Chris Jelpy, in your own questioning of people, do you use Vietnam as a touchstone, as a reference point?
Yeah, we do. Well, when we ask them about casualties in military operations, we give them sort of baselines and talk and tell them about how many casualties we suffered in various different wars, including Vietnam. I do think, you know, I think we should be careful about jumping too quickly to parallels to Vietnam. But I do think there are some similar types of problems here. And I think that Matt is pointing to something that is a real problem, and that is that it's a very tricky thing to try to persuade Iraqis to stand with the United States as an occupying power against the insurgents when the United States is as unpopular as we are in that area of the world. That is a very difficult political problem, and it is similar to the kind of problem that we faced in Vietnam, where fundamentally we were unable to pacify areas of Vietnam because we were not able to get ordinary Vietnamese folks to turn in the Viet Cong.
General Nash, are there times and places when the Army is sent in to do, or the Marines are sent in to do, the sort of work that men with guns just can't do?
Well, I think the answer to that question is yes, but at this point in Iraq, I think there has been a broad understanding that this is not a guns only solution that we have to seek in Iraq. And I will tell you for certain the comments and my knowledge of the commander of Central Command of all the Americans involved in this operation, he knows better than any the fact that the political, economic, social aspects of this engagement are equally important as military. General John Abizaid, the Central Command commander, who is fluent in Arabic, has lived in the region for many years, is well aware of the broad dimensions of this challenge.
Yeah, but the task is getting people to focus on them when you have events like the Fallujah.
Well, that's certainly understandable, and I agree with you. But I would also say that fortunately we have the right guy in charge of this, and it's a tough challenge. There is no doubt about that. But that doesn't mean we don't have the capacity to take it on and ultimately be successful.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Cambridge now. Steve's joining us. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm on a cell phone, so if you hear any weird stuff, that would explain it. But I just wanted to say that this war, for me, in a way, it's not like Mogadishu or like Vietnam, because I don't I think in Mogadishu, two things were true for me as I understood it. First, I felt like we were there for good reason. We could accomplish, you know, we were there to do something that might have been accomplishable if we had put sufficient troops there to provide security for food delivery and so on. But the other thing about Mogadishu, and I may be wrong about this, but because all I saw was the movie, but when the people were, when our troops were pinned down, I think it was the UN that came and got them out in the end. And we weren't even able to get our own troops into Fallujah to do anything about what happened there. It's also not like Vietnam, mm-hmm. because in my mind, we were not humiliated. And there were ways we could extricate ourselves from Vietnam and did eventually that are not open to us in Iraq as long, because we have such a faulty analysis of what we're trying to do, which is that we can create a stable democratic society there. And what happened in Fallujah just increased the intensity of my feelings incredibly. And my feelings, even though I'm a peace person, my feelings of humiliation for Americans' army and American people in that setting, because we really can't do anything about what's happening to us there as long as we are adhering to such a faulty analysis of what we can accomplish.
All right, I'm not going to try and match military history here when I've got General Nash with me on the phone, but it's my recollection that it wasn't men or women in blue helmets that came into Mogadishu, was it?
No, it was not.
Thank you. And just on the question of taking a look at Fallujah and looking ahead, Chris, there's a part of your own research here that we haven't got to that I think is quite important, and that is a sense that you have learned from people that Americans, left, right, Republicans, Democrats, they do look to their political leaders to help them frame a response to an emotional event like the killing that the nation witnessed in Fallujah. And I find it interesting to me and revealing in a way that there's been no formal political response so far. I mean, we've had Scott McClellan speaking on behalf of the president. We've heard Democrats speaking. And I'm not saying everybody zipped their lip, but, you know, at a moment when the president might say something formal or John Kerry might make they haven't done that. What does that tell us?
Yeah, that actually is somewhat surprising to me, because I think you're right that that at moments like this, when some kind of this sort of vivid violence happens, I think our leaders have a lot of room to interpret the meaning of these events for the public that will shape their response. So in Somalia and in Beirut in 1983, our leaders framed these events as failure, and I'm surprised, and as a result, the public support for the operations collapsed. I am surprised that the Bush administration is not, having the president interpret for the American people, what do these images mean and what are we going to do about them? I think they risk allowing others to set the frame. And if the frame becomes set that, you know, what this means is that there's widespread visceral animosity to the U.S. and support for the insurgents, that's going to be very bad news for the Bush administration.
Well, if I could add something to that, I am not quite as disappointed that nobody's talking. First of all, on the Democratic side, I think it's inappropriate for a lot of comments to come out from the Democratic candidate at this time of pretty severe challenges to the nation, and by not speaking, I think there's a degree of support being shown for the national challenge. And as far as the president is concerned, regardless of what your views are with respect to how the war came about, et cetera, it's not all bad to just take a deep breath and figure this thing out a little bit before people start talking.
Yeah, don't misunderstand me, General. I wasn't saying that it was a bad thing we hadn't heard anything. I just thought it was somewhat revealing, and it may be revealing that John Kerry is saying this is not an appropriate time to play politics with a war, and it may be that President Bush is saying this is the appropriate time to let the generals and the military people decide what the appropriate response would be rather than politicizing it.
That's exactly correct, and that may show a degree of wisdom that will help us through this in a way that we might not have expected.
Chris Jalpy, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that may be true. I mean, from a political perspective, I think that the Bush administration is taking a risk in not trying to set the frame strongly for the American public. Mm-hmm. But if Kerry is going to back off and they're going to sort of tacitly cooperate on this, that may indicate as some level of sort of unity in facing this threat and this problem. However, somebody is going to set the frame. So
what you're saying is that the American people are, and we've heard that kind of mix of opinions on our radio program today, are kind of looking for something to help them fix this, whether or not it's witnessing a military response or whether or not it's hearing something from the Roosevelt Room.
Right. They're looking for something to some kind of response for why did this happen and what are we going to do about it and how are we going to fix it? And maybe it'll be enough to have, the generals say, all right, there will be a response as long as that response is forthcoming in relatively short order. That may be enough, but I do think that as part of the fact that we're having this show, I think indicates that the American public is looking around for a lens to interpret this with, and I think the government needs to be careful about what lens gets adopted.
And General Nash, whether or not the military chooses Plan A, B, C, up to and including finding a convenient way to back away from Fallujah, because that was something that was talked about some months back, simply moving the bases further away from those areas. It seems to me that the one thing that comes back on every example that's given, whether it's Mogadishu or Vietnam or Korea or however far back or into ever which corner you want to go here, the one thing that links them all is that what's the route that the U.S. can follow and do it with honor? Moving out with honor, you know, solving the problems with honor, punishing the people but doing it in an honorable way. And that seems to be about the only word that you can't take away from the military or the political options here.
Yeah, I agree with you. As I said earlier, how we conduct ourselves in this time of crisis will have an impact on Iraqi and international and domestic views of what we're involved in. And there's plenty of political debate available for issues of how we got into this war and the wisdom of not only whether or not to do it, but how we did it, especially the post-conflict aspects. But now that we're facing this very severe challenge, how we behave and how we go about and using both force and progress to move this situation ahead will have a lot to do with people's perception as to our intent and our purposes in Iraq.
General Nash, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Nice to have you on the program. Retired General William Nash, Senior Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. And Chris Jelpy, we'll be back in touch with you to find out what the answers to your questions are.
That would be great. I'd be happy to come back.
Chris Jelpy is an Associate Professor of Political Science at Duke University. Earlier in the program, we talked with The New Yorker's John Lee Anderson. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support for NPR.